My Secular Sobriety is a podcast that gives voice to the secular person overcoming addiction and unhealthy behaviors through reason, learning, and community. Well, welcome to episode 11. I'm excited about this one. We're having our friend David Bull back, and I wanted David on because I've been reading his blog posts over the last couple of weeks, which are really pertinent to the current situation that we're all dealing with. But before I get into introducing David, let's say hello to Ben, my co-host. Ben, how are you?
I'm pretty good, John. How are you doing? Dave, good to see you.
You as well, Ben. Thank you.
And Ben, have you been handling everything lately with the
I've been pretty depressed this week off and on. I've had a short fuse with the kids a little bit, and just being stuck inside and not able to go anywhere, it's been wearing on me. So I've had to reach out and talk to plenty of people to pull myself out of it plenty of times.
Well, that's understandable. You know, last time we had David on, I didn't really properly introduce him. So I went to his website, and I thought that I would give listeners an idea, a better idea of what David's background is. So I went to his about page, and I'd like to just read a little paragraph about that to introduce Dave. So David is a graduate of the University of South Florida and Hazelden Betty Ford Graduate School of Addiction Studies. He's a member of the National Association for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse Counselors, American Adoption Congress, and Concerned United Birth Parents. Today, he lives with his wife in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He is a current and former member of a number of national and regional sailing and yachting associations. And I don't know if I realize that, but he also is a volunteer through the Salvation Army and in the recovery community and through a variety of sailing and yachting clubs. So I didn't know all that, but he's also the author of Parallel Universes, which is a wonderful memoir that deals with addiction and the issues facing adoptees that I highly recommend anybody to read. David, welcome. Nice to have you.
Well, thank you for that warm introduction, John. It's my pleasure to be here.
You know, wow, what a world we live in today.
And incredible.
And how unique it is for people in recovery who crave community as a way to deal with their addictions. And we're in this situation where we're socially distant, I guess, but we're still connecting. And mm-hmm. you have written several blog posts over the last few weeks that deal with how we're coping with this new reality. And I thought that we could talk about that a little bit. And maybe a good way to frame this is I'd just like to start by reading maybe the first paragraph in one of your blog posts, New Normal Crossed Out, New Reality. We're all in this together and there's no way out. This is our reality check every day now as we watch the world change drastically as the epidemic grows all around us. What was standard a month ago is now impossible to imagine. For example, meeting with friends for a coffee or eating in a restaurant. Everything is on hold now. Concerts, art openings, movies, renovations, reunions, public celebrations, and many things we haven't yet anticipated. If you open a newspaper today, you will notice the sports section is gone, or perhaps you're an instant adapter and you're shocked at the fact that there are still newspapers being printed for now there are. Wherever you are currently, it's best for your mental health that you acknowledge this is happening, it is ongoing, and it will probably not dissipate any time soon. David, you have the floor. What's going on?
Well, thank you. Well, you know, that reminds me, you know, there was a mentor of mine back when I was able to make the decision and take the action to stop with my alcohol use, who told me that the definition of acceptance was, quote unquote, that's not likely to change anytime soon, end quote. And he did it tongue in cheek because I was complaining about things in life that weren't changing fast enough for my doing. But isn't that the world that we live in today? And it, as you illustrated through that blog post, it's about a new reality. And I keep hearing people talk about this new normal, and I'm sorry, I don't buy it. There's nothing normal about anything we're dealing with currently. This is quite abnormal, but it doesn't mean that it isn't reality and that we shouldn't deal with it. So absolutely we should. And there's any number of ways we can take this discussion. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is the problem has been pretty well defined, and it's an evolving problem. You know, we had our hands around it, wrapped around it not too long ago, but we keep getting more information. And of course, if those of us think about it long and hard, that's exactly what the professionals are telling us, right? They're telling us we need to take some actions, we need to look at the data, and we need to take further action once we see that data. And that's exactly the way we should probably approach this if we're able to pragmatically. Of course, the realistic part about that is that we're stressed, and when people are stressed, we don't think as clearly as we might when we're not stressed. And as you said, it's a really stressful world today. And if you think about stress, people kind of get tripped up on what stress means, because a lot of people felt they were under stress before this got dumped into our laps, right? I mean, people were living in a digital world that was moving at the speed of light and were feeling pretty stressed in and of themselves. But talking about stress is something that we probably want to do in this call. And to say that, the American Psychological Association defines stress as a pattern of specific and non-specific responses to stimulus that disturb equilibrium, which is really important. It disturbs our equilibrium, no doubt, and attacks or exceeds our ability to cope. And that's what we're talking about here, especially as recovering people, right? You know, we built resilience. We built coping techniques over a lifetime. Some of them healthy, some of them not so healthy. But now they're exceeding our ability to cope with those that don't kill us. And that's really what's going on here. And ultimately, stress just upsets our balance. And we're negatively affected by that stress when we haven't evolved our coping strategies to address that stress. And that's not easy to do in a problem that keeps evolving, a problem that we can't get our arms around. So ultimately, you know, what we have to do is we have to learn how to respond rather than react. But again, that's more easily said than done. So, and I don't want to dwell too much on the problem, right? I mean, I think what we have to do, some of us tend to do in our rooms or in our support groups, is talk a lot about the problem. I'd like to talk a bit about the solution, but to do that, I think I want to bring in some historical data. So I'm not doing this to further add to the anxieties of any of your listeners, but to anticipate a little bit better what might lie ahead for us, and specifically those of us in recovery. So, you know, first of all, we ask the question, do these types of disasters historically disrupt lives of people in recovery? And intuitively, we can say, of course they do. We get this, right? When one's environment has changed, when stress is added to an equation, certainly it becomes a relapse trigger. But do we have data on this? And of course, when we look at the historical data, there are all kinds of studies. There are short-term studies. There are long-term studies. There are longitudinal studies over several populations. But when we look at the last three major disasters we've seen, for example, the 2001 9/11 World Trade Center attack, or the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami, or Hurricane Katrina in 2005, what we see are, yes, absolutely, rates of alcohol and drug consumption increased, and rates of addiction and consequences as a result that increase as well. Now, do we have definitive data that says what is the subset of recovering people and how that affected them? Not really. Or when there is some room, the data is not clear. Some of the data shows that there is an immediate effect in relapse over the years one and two, but by year three, most people have returned to homeostasis or their set pattern that they had before. But that's right, we're talking about people here instead of statistics, so we have to be careful with that. So what we need to look around. What are we seeing today? What are we seeing today in the news? Well, we're seeing states making decisions or not decisions to leave their alcohol sales, whether they're businesses or state-run agencies, open because of the problems that will accrue if they shut off the alcohol supply. Problems with people going through DTs, problems, people going into the emergency room when, in fact, there's not a lot of room in our emergency rooms right now due to the COVID pandemic. So we are seeing that in the news today. And yes, there is a major concern, especially among recovering people, with that disruption of routine that we're talking about, being isolated, being hunkered down, safer at home is what they call it in my home state of Wisconsin here, that might trigger relapse, and that lack of medical resources enable to respond to an overdose. So yeah, it's ultimately a problem.
I was wondering if they were keeping the liquor stores open for that very reason, because if someone's addicted to alcohol, if they don't have it, it could be life-threatening.
Exactly correct.
And
so
even if
we know ultimately, historically, is that when stress goes up, the use of coping mechanisms goes up, not only because it has to, but it does. right? But that means both healthy coping mechanisms and unhealthy coping mechanisms increase. So we absolutely know anecdotally and scientifically that, yes, this is a problem. This will cause problems for people in recovery. It will cause stresses, it will cause triggers, and it will cause some relapses, no doubt about it. Now, what are researchers, those same researchers or those researchers involved in the field thinking about today? Well, they're warning us that this pandemic could inflict long-term emotional trauma on a scale like we've never seen before, a global scale, because this is a global event. And I don't want to be myopic and say Hurricane Katrina was only a localized event, but when studying the trauma, that's the way it looked like. So we also know that the combined stressors in this COVID-19 are a lot different than other disasters, and we've never seen them all together in one place, right? We've seen the loss of life, we've seen loss of property, we've seen loss of lifestyle, but we haven't seen the isolation and all the things that we're seeing is in combination of COVID. And there are many experts, scientists predicting that the scale of this in terms of mental health effect is going to be something we've never seen before. Again, I'm not trying to be opportunistic or reactionary, but that's something we have to anticipate. So knowing that, we have some control over this situation, right? So we know that people with, for example, unhealed emotional traumas, these increased stressors of today may bring on overwhelming emotions and might even bring some functional impairment, right? I've had some of my clients say, I'm paralyzed to do anything. Right? It's not that they're motivated. They know exactly what they need to do. They just can't bring themselves to do it because they've maxed out their coping responses already in dealing with that previous trauma or dealing with what we've seen over the past 2 months happening in our very country. So the question is okay, it causes stress, but is this coronavirus problem and pandemic really causing trauma? Trauma as we know it. And trauma can be a generalized term, or it could be PTSD trauma, capitalized post-traumatic stress disorder trauma. Well, it's not a direct answer to that. And everybody reacts differently to stressful situations and trauma. Now, how I respond to an outbreak can depend on my background and experiences, characteristics that make me different from anybody else in the community in which I live. But what we know are some things that are factual, right? We know that older people are more susceptible and at higher risk, including to the stress surrounding it. Children and teens are particularly susceptible to this because they don't have the wisdom, right? The foundation with which to process this new information, theoretically, right? People helping in response to the COVID-19, or the frontline people, the healthcare providers, first responders, doctors, are obviously more prone to stress in this crisis. And the fourth group of people who are most prone to this are people who have mental health conditions, including substance use and behavioral disorders, right? So yes, the answer is yes. Yes, this is can be causing a great deal of stress, and as a result, trauma and consequences, negative consequences of trauma for a great many people. In addition, it's already happening. Right? Anecdotally, I can tell you this. I'm hearing news reports of this, but because things are still growing and the consequences of the pandemic have not leveled out, this is happening at an increasing rate. So this fear and worry about our own health that we all have in terms of the stress may be even increasing over time, right? The change in our sleeping or eating patterns are going to manifest over time in greater ways. If we're having difficulty sleeping or concentrating now, which is usually a function of stress and trauma, that may only increase over time. There's no end in sight. We don't know where this goes. Right? If we have some chronic health problems, including addiction, those are going to worsen over time as a result of stress. They don't get better as a result of stress or trauma. And of course, it's all, as I said before, this all leads to that increased use of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. And by the way, there are a lot of people out there who are suffering. And I hope it's not inappropriate to say this on your broadcast, John, but you know, if there's someone out here listening that needs help, or if you know someone who does, please do something about it. You know, don't sit isolated and not do anything about it. If you're feeling overwhelmed with emotions, you've got extreme sadness or depression or anxiety, or feel like you want to harm yourself or others, make the call, right? Call 911 or visit the disaster helpline at samhsa.gov, or call a national domestic violence helpline if that's something that needs to be done. Take action now, be proactive about it, and put yourself in a position to take care of yourself. So having said that, the answer to the original question is yes, collectively, we are experiencing trauma and severe stress. There's no doubt about it. The question still remains, can this trauma and stress manifest in PTSD? The answer is yes, for some. Absolutely. It can't, I mean, if you lose a loved one or a close relationship to the disease, or you suffer a continuing series of loss events, that is real PTSD type trauma. Absolutely, that can happen. Also, we can talk about development trauma. This can also be caused by longer term stresses and worrying about the present day and the future, including losses that we might have, losses of autonomy and freedom, losses of our lifestyles. Most importantly, loss of ideals about what we think the world should be like and what our lives should be like and what our relationships should be like. So it's that developmental trauma, they call it small T trauma in some circles, is something that even if we don't have direct losses in our families or in our lines of friendships, that we are susceptible to.
You know, I'm getting depressed again all over again.
Right.
I think, Ben, you had a thought. I think you were going to, you wanted to say something. Did you have a thought?
I don't remember exactly what it was, but a few things you said, Dave, kind of ruminated in my mind. You know, yeah, the liquor stores being open and that whether somebody has an alcohol problem or not, that is the way a lot of people cope. I mean, I tend to think it's not a healthy way to cope, obviously, whether you're an alcoholic or not. But yeah, our liquor stores were open here and our governor said people are still doing carry out in restaurants. And now restaurants are allowed to give you a carry out cup of a mixed drink of alcohol. Mm-hmm. You had to remind everybody that that doesn't mean you can drink it in your car on the way home.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's interesting because I think you're right. They do know that that people use that as a coping strategy. And I know a friend of mine is a distributor for Budweiser here in town. And he said right when things started getting serious and everybody was taking it serious, he said his 3-day, 4-day period right around then was sales were just like a 4th of July weekend. As mm-hmm. far as alcohol. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And this is a, I think, I'm probably going to get a little bit political here too, but I think the thing I react to too, for me personally, is it's, we don't feel it. I feel like we've had a really partisan time in our country. It's always been partisan, but it feels especially partisan leading up to this. And I also think when you don't have adequate leadership and the ability to empathize, it is hard to bring everybody together and feel like we're together on this as a community, as just a function of our country. You know, you have states battling each other for equipment that is usually kept for, you know, backup and things like that. So to relate this back to recovery, you said earlier too, sometimes meetings, this is a pet peeve of mine. I'd love to talk about this a little bit later. It's one of the problems I have with 12-step communities is, sometimes a meeting or a discussion goes off the rails because everybody's so stuck in the problem. But I also see that the opposite problem exists in AA. I grew up with a mother who could not listen to how a person's feelings. The first thing she would do is dismiss it and give you a solution. Sometimes I think 12-step communities do that as well. It's like we can't stand to live with, and again, it's not okay to stay in this, like John said, ooh, I'm getting re-depressed all over again. But it's not good to stay in that without functioning and trying to move towards a solution or a healthy way to cope. But sometimes I feel like in recovery communities, and unfortunately, people who counsel, myself included, who work at 12-step-based facilities especially, people don't always get encouraged to dig in and do the emotional work. Now, that's really hard to do. You shouldn't probably do that when you're early in recovery. But I feel like the people who have been in longer-term recovery, something like this comes up, and it can really re-traumatize and reactivate all that stuff you maybe haven't dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I talked in a whole lot of circles around there.
No, that's a lot. But you said a mouthful. It was something that really jumped out at me, Ben, was you're talking about the idealism of AA, and that's the parallel to what's going on right now in my mind in the pandemic, right? So in AA, we all go in, we're told, and I'm not bashing AA in any way, but we're told, here's the problem, here's the solution, and here are the promises, right? And in an ideal world, that's how it should work, and that's how AA groups and how working the steps and sponsors should function. We should all be working towards that solution. But after time, we learn that sort of some groups just aren't for us. That group isn't getting me to that goal like I need to get to that goal, so I need to find something else. But the hope isn't that there's always something else, right? Right now, in the pandemic, the parallel is really different, right? Because we've all lost that ideal as well, right? The ideal is what life should be like, or what it should be like over the short term, when it's going to be like something different over the long term, and what that's eventually going to look like. But we have nowhere to turn. We don't have somewhere to hide or to go or to find ourselves a safe environment to do that. So that's an immensely important distinction to make in this day and age. Additionally, with regard to the liquor sales, right? I mean, I understand the comments you're making. I don't want to shill for anybody because I live in the state of Wisconsin, which grew up on the brewery industry in the 1800s, whose largest lobbying group in the entire state is the Tavern League. So I'm not defending the purveyors of alcohol, especially those who do it in an unhealthy and unsolved way. But the fact of the matter is I don't think we understand as a society yet what this all means. I think of Ohio, for example. Ohio initially said, yes, the liquor stores are going to be an essential business. They're going to remain open. And a few days later, they reversed their stance and closed all the liquor stores. Mm-hmm. What did they learn in that interim? And do they really have the time to communicate at that level, right? It's important to us. Is it important to the general public, right? That's the ultimate question. And they decided they have time to communicate about other things, but they don't need to explain this to the general public. And that makes it very difficult for those of us in recovery or those of us attempting or anticipating recovery to try to figure it out. So yeah, I think you said some great things there. Absolutely.
You know, it's funny, just a little aside, Wisconsin truly is a big drinking state. My brother used to live there. He lived in La Crosse. And it was like literally a liquor store, like every single corner, and the whole society kind of was around beer tents and drinking and all that. So yeah,
absolutely.
I can understand that.
But, well, again, and you're right, and I don't think, well, the state is definitely soaked in alcohol, if you will. Yeah, I'm starting to realize or have come to realize that this is happening at all levels. You know, sometimes when we have political events or other crises in the country, they tend to focus on the coasts or the larger cities, and they don't necessarily filter into the more rural areas. But you know what? That's not the case here, and I have direct evidence in my county. You mentioned in my introduction, I lived in Milwaukee. Well, I've since moved to a more rural area about 30 miles southwest of the city called Walworth County. And in Walworth County, for example, we have about 102 or 103,000 residents at last count. And we're the 14th largest out of the 72 counties in Wisconsin, so we're pretty small, actually. There aren't a whole lot of people here. But as of yesterday, we had 16 coronavirus cases. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but it really is, given that how remote people are here, 5 of which are currently hospitalized and 9 have been recovered. We have no deaths, thankfully. But this has prompted the sheriff of our county to issue a statement, and he has basically said, and I'm going to read it because this is really important. In this tiny little county in Wisconsin where we think we're sheltered from some of these things, said the mental health impact of the COVID pandemic is significant. We're already beginning to see the effects of prolonged isolation and job loss. The county is experiencing a marked increase in reports of drug use, suicide, and other mental health needs. Mm-hmm. So again, I don't want to focus too much on the problem. We're not here to depress John or anyone else any further, but we have to realize what the problem is before we attack it. And the problem is that we are under stress. We are being affected by this, and we need to realize what's going on. So what? How do we realize if it's affecting us negatively or not? Right? We can be down in mood, and we can talk to friends, and sometimes that we go down the rabbit hole, we spiral into more things. But how do we look at our emotional states, right? And how do we know that those emotional states that we created in the past aren't healthy coping mechanisms anymore, right? I mean, I'll give you a quick example. My short story as an alcoholic was I had a relatively developmentally obscured upbringing where my perceptions of the world and relationships were very difficult to navigate. I found alcohol by accident at age 13, and it became the magic elixir. It was a prescription for a problem I didn't even know I had, right? So here I am finding alcohol, and it's become a coping mechanism that I believe saved my social life and perhaps saved my identity. That allowed me to get further on in life. But there was a time in life where later on it boomeranged, there was no longer a healthy coping mechanism. It almost killed me. Right? And that's what's going on now, right? So what coping mechanisms have we used in everyday life or in stressful situations that may be getting unhealthy now, right? If people are dissociating and staying numb, that's okay for short periods of time, but over a long period of time, that only adds to more disconnection, right? If people are angry and fearful, that's okay. That's a natural reaction. But where do we go with that anger and that fear, right? Are we turning it inward and blaming ourselves or blaming the world with nowhere to take that? Or what are we doing with that? Some people, as we've talked about already, get paralyzed and depressed. And those symptoms tend to go on. At the same time, they may also feel anxiety, which is an opposite feeling, but it is not a good feeling nonetheless. And again, some people alter their realities with chemicals and compulsive behaviors.
I can tell that it affects me pretty deeply just from my dreams. I had two weird dreams last night that I've never had before. In one dream, my boss was upset because she had to think about laying people off. And in the other dream, I was a surgeon and I had to go to surgery. Then I had to perform surgery in the morning. Fortunately for me, I just had to do a podcast. But I think that is all the news that I've been hearing about people losing their jobs and these medical mm-hmm. professionals having, you know, it sounds to me like a hospital in New York is like the last damn place I'd want to be.
Right, right.
Exactly. And so that's, you know, that's just kind of, I might not realize at a level, but when I'm sleeping, my mind is playing these things to me.
Exactly. And it's part of that helplessness that we're all collectively feeling, right? I'm with you, John. I've had a series of dreams over the past four decades as an adult, and they manifest in they come in different ways. But the upshot of all of them is that I'm in a situation and I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
I just have no idea what to do. And I feel worse and worse because I don't know what to do. Well, I've had those dreams a lot lately, right? Because we just don't know what to do.
Our situation, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. Or perhaps it's because we're taking on more responsibility than we should have. I'm not positioned to cure this. You know, so maybe I should be focusing on, and this is ideal, of course, maybe I should be focusing on what I can control, on coping and building resilience so that I can stay strong and maybe even brace myself for more to come, right? Because that's what we're doing. So ultimately, you know, you had asked me when you came to speak, how do we do this? How do we deal with the stress and the trauma of this, and how do we mitigate those stressors and consequences relating to everything that's going on? And the answers are simple. I think we know most of them ourselves, but it's tough to focus on them. It's tough to implement them when we're feeling all of those symptoms that I mentioned before, especially if we're paralyzed, depressed, anxious, or turning to chemicals. But there are three simple things. One, stay in the present. Two, monitor our habits, emotions, and our thoughts. And three, focus on what we can control. Right? Staying in the present is not easy to do when it, all about us is fear and we don't know where this ends. But mindfulness, and when I talk about mindfulness, I don't mean talk about calming the mind. I mean, noticing thoughts as they come over us is a really important tool to practice. And guess what? Now we have time to do it. And those of us who are working at home, who may have a little extra time on hands because we're not commuting, although we may still be working, we now have a little extra time in our day. If we take the responsibility to do that, to do something proactive, right? That's part of the prescription right then and there. We're going to start feeling better almost immediately. But learning these skills, this staying present mindfulness skill, is an excellent way, and it has a huge evidence base in coping with the symptoms of PTSD, right? So what we have to do is recognize those internal triggers and use breath work or even use a daily diary to becoming self-aware and reducing those feelings of emotional distress. And there are all kinds of wonderful things online that you can do. And I don't know if you've seen this Nomadic Ambiance. It's a series of YouTube videos. I'll say it again. Nomadic, like nomad, N-O-M-A-D-I-C, Ambiance, A-M-B-I-E-N-C-E. It's a series of videos of an individual walking through different situations. And the one that really works for me the most is this individual walking the streets of New York in a rainstorm. And literally, you know, you see the sights and the sounds. It is so realistic that I can almost smell the smells of the rain in New York City. And it's phenomenal to center me in the present. So please, you know, people take the time to do that. And you know, we talk about this in our recovery rooms all the time, but now more than ever is a great time to do that. Another way to work on this is to check our feelings and our emotions and thoughts. And any number of ways to do that. Some of us use 12-step fellowships. Some of us use CBT techniques. Some of us use dialectical behavioral techniques. Some of us do other things. But in times of stress, you know, it's more important to gauge our emotions and thoughts as well as our habits, right? Because we're sitting around a lot, right? I mean, you've seen all the memes on social media, right? The soccer player who came out of quarantine who's got a beer belly, right? And you've seen all these things. So we need to connect those thoughts and emotions with the behaviors. And we have to realize what isn't working at the same time. I have a lot of people that I talk to, including clients and friends, who are just overwhelmed with the news, right? I mean, I was guilty of it as well. A month ago, I was watching, you know, not 24/7, but almost every waking hour, I had the news channels on, and I was trying to get as much information as I can. Now, I've realized that because of the 15-minute or sometimes 15-second news cycle we live under, that's not necessarily helpful, and sometimes it's triggering, right? And then now I limit my news sources mostly to the CDC and the World Health Organization, but sometimes I'll turn on the local news to see what's going on.
That's a huge tip.
We talk to a lot of people during the day so that I remain connected and I'm not living under a rock.
Yeah, my employer actually came out with that.
For focusing on what we can control.
Yeah, yeah. Our employer gave us some tips of how to deal with this, and one thing they did suggest, which I learned pretty early on, was don't overdo the news, listening to news all the time. And also, that's just a common thing. I was watching the Bill Maher show last night, which was absolutely hilarious. Did you see that, Ben?
I did, John.
He was all by himself. But anyway, he talked about that too. He said he had to turn off the news. Couldn't listen to it all time, you know. Or maybe Seth, what's the guy's name? Seth
McFarlane.
Maybe he said that. But that was a great show. I mean, at one point, you know, he has no studio audience. He's at his home, and at one point, he played this old 1950s clip of an audience. You got to see that. Anyway, sorry for interrupting you.
No, I get it.
Dave, I want to say I appreciated your statement earlier. I know we kind of skated over it, but you said we went from what we thought was our normal to a new reality. And what's one person's normal is everybody's normal was a little bit different. Now, all of a sudden, we're all under a very, very similar reality. Mm-hmm. And you led that into talking about coping techniques and all that stuff. You know, and I've said this other places too. It's so easy to talk about how prepared we are for things, but we are such behaviors of habit or creatures of habit, and we like certainty. You know, we like to think we know what to expect, but the reality, and you know, our society is probably more predictable than it's ever been. I mean, however many years ago, we were just probably like a little squirrel in the park looking around for something that might come down and grab us at some time. But, you know, so I feel like too, this whole thing is throwing everybody into this same boat, like you're saying. And, you know, even like, let's say everybody, you know, likes to bash the wealthy or something like this. There's maybe a lot of people who are preparing to retire who all of a sudden that's a new thing for. So they're brought back to a common reality that a lot of people are having that is very real trauma as well, or the uncertainty about knowing what the economy will do. And so on some level, good can come of this because I think we all are part of a similar reality now. And I hope we can hang on to something about that. But I also appreciate you bringing up the domestic violence thing because I used to facilitate a domestic violence program, and you know, I can't fathom being a victor, and now you're trapped in the house 24/7 with your perpetrator. Where in the past maybe you would have at least got out to, or they got out to work, or you got out to work if you were in the situation where you were working as well. So This is a dangerous time, not to bring it back to depressing stuff, but this is a dangerous time for those people that people don't always think about, I don't think, in society.
Agreed. And I think that's a really great point, Ben. At the same time, I would also say we can't possibly think about all those things, thank goodness, right? I mean, I heard talk to a friend the other day whose daughter is in med school, and they have suspended all of their practicums, all of their internships, because the supplies used during their internships were needed in emergency room hospitals, and they now don't have the supplies to complete their internships. So you can imagine, right? I mean, it's not something that we deal with every day, but take that a step further, right? I mean, right. If the average med student has $200,000 in student loans, and now they don't have a path to graduate and apply their skills in the real world, they're suffering some real stressors. So yeah, you're absolutely right. We're in this together. The myriad of ways this can affect us is incredible. And of course, the most susceptible to us, to these stressors and traumas are the ones who are mentally vulnerable in the first place, the people that you described and the people that we have been in touch with, people with addiction, psychological issues, or some emotional damage in the past, right? So this is important that we deal with this now. And as recovering people, we think we know what to do, right? I mean, not to be overly simplistic, but we think we know what to do. We think we should attend our online meetings and we should talk to our sober and recovering friends, and we should stay connected with accountability partners, and we should listen to podcasts, and we should never, ever give ourselves permission to reach out for a drink. But what does that look like, right? What does that look like in the age of isolation, right? It's not always easy to discern those types of things. So sometimes we have to come at it in different ways, right? Applying those recovery techniques may work, but how else do we build resilience? And is there a language that we can translate from recovery language that will help us to approach this? And of course, what we're talking about here, I think, is acceptance more than anything. Right? We talk about reality and how exhausting it is to fight that reality, that collective reality, but it doesn't work, you know, and refusal to accept that reality, or to more realistically, the refusal to accept that that reality is going to expand, could cause some further pain, right? And that avoidance leads to that addiction, the depression, the anxiety, and the other challenges that we talk about. So, you know, we know what it's like not to accept our alcoholism, but how do we know we're not accepting what's going on? Well, you know, I hear people use these statements all the time. You know, this just isn't fair. I can't stand this. And of course that's used for Trump more than it is for anything else. I can't stand him. Right. Or this can't be happening, or things shouldn't be this way. Right. Those to me are immediate signs that people have an accepted reality, but they need to do that to build the resilience. Right. And we've talked about this. We need to walk into that pain and disappointment and sadness and that loss of lifestyle autonomy and ideals in order to build that resilience going forward. And particularly, we need to grieve these losses. Mm-hmm. I'm not hearing about this in any way, shape, or form. Maybe it's too early in the process for the media to be picking up on this. We need to be grieving these losses because they may multiply, they may increase, especially on the developmental level. If we have a series of stresses and losses over a period of time, we need to grieve them as they occur, not to wait till everything is over, because we might stand a chance at the end of that time. And yeah. Recovery language is recovery language, but there's also language out there. And I referred to it earlier. One of the most progressive techniques of dealing with all of this is dialectical behavioral therapy, or using dialectical behavioral techniques, DBT. It was actually a concept and science created by Marshall Linehan back in 1993, based on the concept of radical acceptance. Radical acceptance, we have to accept that which was in front of us, that which we cannot deny. And really, there are only four things that you can do to solve a problem. And those of us in recovery learn these things. One, we can solve it. And we can change perceptions. We can practice acceptance, radical acceptance. Or we can stay miserable. Right? I mean, we can do those four things. We have a choice every day to do that. And many of us grew up, I mean, cut our teeth in 12-step fellowship, learning the Serenity Prayer. That's exactly what the Serenity Prayer and recovery language talks about. What do we need to do? Well, sounds to me like I need to change my perceptions, and I have to practice radical acceptance and solve those things in front of me, solve those things that I'm responsible for, as opposed to solving this collective problem that's going to take time to play out, right? So this DBT therapy or techniques are really good. It's a cognitive behavioral therapy. It relates our thoughts to the actions that we have taken, maybe unhealthily, and need to take to be more healthily. And it tries to change that. Well, it tries to first identify that negative thinking and then change it into patterns that push for positive behavioral change. The word dialectic is really key. And I learned this oftentimes the hard way in recovery circles. The term dialectic comes from the idea that two opposites can be happening at the same time. I can hold two thoughts at the same time. I can hate the fact that there is violence in this world, but at the same time, I can accept it. And I can accept that I have a responsibility not to perpetrate it in my life, but I can't always help other people to do it in other lives. So dialectical, bringing these two opposites together, the acceptance and the change, where oftentimes people get tripped up on that Serenity Prayer, right? What do I have the courage? What do I have the power to change? And what can I accept? It's, they come together in this DBT, and they mold it really well, I think. There's some really easy books out there. Someone's looking for them. I can make references to the layperson. I just checked on Amazon.com before we came here. They're about a week out, which is a lot better than they would have been a few weeks or a week or two ago, and they might have been 3 weeks out to get this. But there's a book called Dialectical Therapy Skills Workbook by Matthew McKay that has instant exercises that people can do to do these things. And ultimately, what we're trying to do collectively and individually are the following. Here's what DBT focuses on. And you guys let me know if this rings true to what we're talking about. The first thing it talks about is dealing with is distress tolerance. How do we tolerate the distress? Oh my goodness, we have nothing but distress in our world today. We can't turn on our computers without seeing distress. How do we tolerate this, right? How do we make something meaningful out of it? How do we feel these intense emotions like anger without reacting impulsively or self-injuring or using substances to somehow dampen that distress? So distress tolerance is the first thing it focuses on. Secondarily is emotional regulation. Right? We talked about this a minute ago. How do we identify those emotions that we're feeling and label them to adjust those emotions to be more proactive or more productive for us? Or how do we realize where to go with those emotions rather than caving in on ourselves? The third component of DBT is mindfulness. Again, we talked about mindfulness earlier. Becoming more aware of ourselves and others and our thoughts and being more attentive to the present moment takes away and relieves ourselves of the fears of unknown things in the future. And the last thing is our catch-all category that we're all experiencing today is the interpersonal effectiveness area. How do we navigate conflict? How do we navigate relationships? And how do we interact assertively, right? I think many of us have learned to do that through social media. Many of us are doing that in Zoom rooms. Many of us are going to different types of support groups in those chat rooms. I have instituted a few weeks ago a family meeting. I have family all over the country where we get together on Monday nights and we do a Zoom meeting to improve that interpersonal effectiveness. To not only stay connected with one another, right? Stay connected is a term that sometimes gets passed over. We're always told to stay connected. Don't isolate, stay connected. But part of that staying connected is having accountability partners. People who look at us and say, boy, I usually see you in a button-down shirt, David, and you're shaved. Look, what's with the beard today? Is everything okay? Right? Some people can call you out and hold you accountable for those healthy goals that you're trying to do. So that's what DBT is all about. And we can employ it easily. You don't need a manual to employ it. If you Google it, there's some great articles on it. If you focus on those four areas and consciously focus on those four areas, it's really empowering. It's really empowering. And that lots of people, as I said, are able to relate it to their recovery language. I've purposely not gone too deeply into recovery language here because I know you, John and Ben, you have a wide array of individuals who listen to this podcast. I don't want to put it into language that might interfere with their understanding of it. I would encourage them to translate it. And if all else fails, right, we can look at the Stoic philosophers, right? This is my favorite. And I people ask me, what does my recovery program look like? What does my daily program look like? And I tell them it's founded on Stoic philosophy and existential philosophy, basically. And the Stoic philosophers had this concept called the IDEA method. It was an acronym, IDEA method. And basically what they said is, think about this, before the times of Christ, they're writing this stuff down. They're saying idea. I need to identify what the real issue is here. So is the real issue that there's a COVID pandemic in the United States, or is the real issue is that I can't get my arms around what that's going to look like in my life tomorrow, let alone 9 months from now? I'd suggest that the real issue is the latter. Right? We have great experts out there dealing with this problem, hopefully collectively and hopefully quickly and hopefully apolitically as best they can, although we know that not to be true. The real issue is how I'm dealing with it. What do I need to do, and how do I help the people in my life to deal with it?
That's what it seems it boils down to.
It's really simple.
That's what it seems like it all boils down to, doesn't it, Dave? It's like there's absolutely nothing we can do to change the situation, but if we're going to really focus into the solution is all about accepting the reality, dealing with our emotions about the reality. And
exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. It's pretty much all we can do. And for God, sometimes it's easier said than done, you know, but I just feel for the people that have lost their jobs, that have loved ones that are sick. God, I mean, it's tough stuff. It's tough stuff.
And healthcare workers.
Yeah.
It is. It is absolutely. So having said that, you know, we began our discussion saying, are people going to be affected by stress and trauma, and might this turn into PTSD trauma? We said yes for some. The fact of the matter is that most of us are already affected by this, right? We know people who this is affected if we haven't been affected already, and we need to deal with it, right? We need to deal with it at a time where there are more pressing issues. Right? There are more pressing issues to dealing with flattening the curve than there are to my neighbor who was just laid off, who needs to deal with the income loss over the short-term period of time, right? So,
yeah, you know, that's a conversation I have with people too. Like initially when this pandemic was first kind of making its way through the United States, a lot of 12-step meetings were shutting down, but some weren't. Some people were clinging on. They didn't want to shut their meeting. They were holding on to their meetings for as long as they right. could. And there was a real division, I think, between us on that. But I don't know where I was going
with
that.
As evidenced, by the way, John, I'm sorry to interrupt, by a very active discussion in one of the Facebook rooms. Absolutely. Yes, mm-hmm. That is very true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was kind of disturbing. Oh, yeah, I know where I was going with that. So I was talking about the importance of not attending these meetings, because like you said, to flatten the curve, we needed to stop spreading this thing around. So shut your meetings down, go online. That's the most important thing. And then someone brought up the thing, well, what about homeless people that can't get online and all this kind of stuff? And you know, it's like, there's a lot of suffering in the world. We're not going to be able to address all of it, but we got to mitigate. We got to take care of what we can. You know, why add on to it? I mean, I have a brother who's homeless right now. I have no idea how he's going to deal with this situation, but I can't do anything about that. But I can do something about my own situation here. And that's what I think that people need to focus on is like, yeah, there's a lot of suffering, but just deal with what you can. Don't add more to it. Don't add onto the pile.
That's why that DBT is important. And I appreciate how you talked about that, Dave, because I do find that people that struggle with addiction issues or whatnot, it is about that binary thinking. It's all like either we have to help everybody or, you know, it's just like what you were saying, John, about it. We got to have the meeting open because a homeless person might miss it or this or that. And it's about accepting that reality and accepting that there's another perspective on it and that we can't do it all and that there's not going to be a perfect way. An example for me yesterday, like I just had one of those days. It was me and the kids. My wife had work all day and I just could not engage. Like I was engaged, but I wasn't engaged. But I admitted that to myself. Now, if I would not have done that, I maybe would have been more brusque and short with the kids and maybe hollered when they did something I didn't want them to do. But I accepted the fact that it was really hard for me to engage yesterday. And I was able to make it through it without hollering or getting mad about something stupid that wasn't really that big a deal that a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old were able to do. And I made it through the day more successfully than if I wouldn't have practiced being present with myself to know that I just can't get it going today as far as like being the greatest dad in the world. So mm-hmm. then again, there's that binary thinking. Either I'm doing a great job as a dad that day, or I'm being the worst dad possible and I'm traumatizing these kids and they're never going to grow up right because of that. So I accepted that I was in a place that I couldn't engage as fully as I wanted to yesterday, but I didn't make it worse by acting out of that.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. And isn't it really important as well, just as John said, to not dwell on the negative? You know, there are some, and I'm not saying this pandemic is good, but I'm saying that we're realizing some good things as a result of our reaction to it, right? We're realizing that we can gather virtually to support one another because we have to, right? We have to, mm-hmm. right? We can do that. Yes, ideally face-to-face would be better. Yes, it's much easier to look someone in the eye when you're able to shake their hand or to give them a hug. But virtually, we can do this. We can do this, and we can do this together. Absolutely. Addiction treatment, at least in the U.S., and I can't speak for Canada, was really suffering a blow because bringing people into that environment was one way of not flattening the curve and checking the COVID, right? Initially, treatment centers were taking people's temperature and screening for it and admitting them to groups, and then they realized, no, this is not going to work. What we need to do is we need to get virtual treatment going, and rather than having to eat that cost, to their, I guess, compliment, the managed care and insurance companies stepped up and now are reimbursing for partial hospitalization / day treatment and intensive outpatient therapy. So one can go to those therapies now in most areas, I think it is now most areas, and get the treatment that they need, the outpatient treatment that they need. That wasn't happening before. That was impossible. And managed care companies, quite frankly, were not interested in providing it on the basis that we had to do this face-to-face. Now they've stepped up and they've done what they need to do, and it's a good thing. Same is happening in our 12-step rooms. We're getting that support, right? Many online sponsors and many AA groups are saying, no, we have to meet face-to-face. Now, that's an ideal, right? And we'd be better mourn that loss of ideal because we can't meet face-to-face. We have to do it virtually, right? And that's part of that idea method from the Stoic philosophy. The D is distinguishing the internals from the externals. What can we control and what can we not control? What do we have to accept? What do we have to let go, right? That's we have to accept we live in an age where we cannot gather face-to-face, right? And just says, start wearing bandanas and handkerchiefs. In lieu of masks as individuals who go outside your doors. Right? There are things that we have to adjust to and we have to accept. And once we do that, then it gets easy, right? We can exert our effort, that E in the idea method, exert effort only where it can be effective. Focus on our attitude. We focus on one thing that's really important. And then the A is accept the rest. But if there's one message I would say is that what's most important today, that what the effort can we focus on the most is routine. Right? What's going to get us through this is routine. Right. And I see people, and I hope they're joking mostly about how bored they are on social media. My goodness, I'm anything but bored. My business has gotten busier than it's ever been. My phone is ringing off the hook, and I have more to do in front of me on my computer in terms of personal learning, expansion, all kinds of things than I've ever had to do before. Yes, I can't physically go out and meet people and do the things that I did before, and I have to consciously take the time to get up and move around, but that's what I have to control. I can control my routine. And in that routine comes safety, right? The ultimate response to wrap this all around to this response to stress and trauma that will affect some of our recoveries and our ability to use healthy coping mechanisms is safety and trust. And building routine in this day and era is the best way to immediately build safety and trust in what's going on. Take control of what's in front of us. Look at what's in front of us and take control. Right? If we're not commuting that 40 minutes to and from work anymore, use that to connect with a friend who can hold us accountable, or use it to do some meditation or learn meditation online, or to take a personal development class, or to do something to build that resilience so that we know we are proactively doing something rather than reacting to the latest news. And of course, in our lifetimes, I believe that the latest news is only going to get more and more frequent. It's only going to get more digitalized and more immediate, and we're going to have to deal with it. So find a routine, whatever that looks like. Now, back in the days of treatment, I know when I was in treatment, that's how I got sober. I admitted myself to a detox in a treatment facility. They had us block off the hours of every day, and that would look like, so that we could anticipate where the stressors were going to come in our lives once we walked outside the door of that treatment center. That may not be a bad idea for some people to do today, to look at their schedules that aggressively and say, what is this hour going to look like, so that I don't have that white noise of the news networks blaring on my TV in the background, so that I'm doing something more active and proactive to handle the stressors that I know I'm experiencing, and those stressors that I don't even know what they look like that are likely to come later on.
Yeah, I'm like you. I have a pretty active routine. And one thing that's been a lifesaver for me has been podcasting, to be honest with you. That's been a great way for me to connect with other people and to keep me busy and occupied and use my creative interests and so forth. But, you know, we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this as individuals. We're going to get through this collectively as a society. And we might very well come out better in the end. You know, this is a new reality. Things will never be the same again, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be worse. I mean, we might now learn new ways of working, you know, more efficient ways of working that will be better for the environment. We might learn that we have a responsibility for each other in the society. We might learn that our government might have other priorities other than building tanks and missiles. You know, so the politics could change. A lot of things can change. And so we're going to come through this. It's going to be interesting to see what's on the other end. You know,
that's really well said. And in keeping with our discussion of trauma, that's a brilliant point, John, right? I mean, when we talk about where can we become more effective, and that's my belief. I believe we're going to come out of this being more resilient. And I don't want to be flippant, quoting Nietzsche saying, what doesn't kill us will make us stronger. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about us consciously and collectively taking the effort to become more resilient over time is really what's going to save us here. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this trauma, this PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're going to turn it into something that's recognized generally as a solution to that, and that's post-traumatic stress growth. We're going to see growth as a society and individually as a result of this. But to do that, we better take care of ourselves to get
today.
To that point.
And yeah, that's absolutely. About today. Well, we've gone for almost an hour now. We may as well go ahead and start shutting down, I think. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you again. Again, if you haven't visited David's blog, I cannot stress how good his writing is. And really, it's amazing stuff and really relevant to today. And it was kind of funny. David posted one of his blog posts on a Facebook group that I have, and somebody harped at him. That was unacceptable. The guy should have read the article. You know. Anyway, so thank you once again for listening to My Secular Sobriety. This has been our 11th episode. It's hard to believe, you know, we've been doing this for a little while now, and it's just been great. And I hope that we can continue having wonderful guests like David. And, you know, last week we had Katie, who was a pleasure to listen to. Thank you, Ben, for doing this with me. It's been wonderful to connect with you again and to talk with you on a regular basis. And David, keep coming back. I definitely will continue following your blog, and we can have this conversation again and as it develops. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John and Ben. I appreciate it. I enjoyed our chat today and would look forward to doing so in the future.
Absolutely.
Always great.